Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending on where you are. Thanks so much for attending the first of these three workshops to explore the issues of human rights and labour rights in the wine industry. We see this as a vitally important topic and one which SWR intends to focus on in the coming months and years. This workshop series is intended to be a first step. We'd very much like to thank the Nordic Alcohol Monopolies for supporting and funding these workshops. As we've said before, membership fees only pay to keep the SWR lights on, and any policy and practice work we do relies on additional funding. So thank you to Systembolaget, Vinmonopolet, and Alko. So why do we want to do this? Why are we here today? Quite simply, these are important issues, vitally important issues, for which there's a growing urgency for the sector to address head-on. The wine sector has excellent practices on the environmental aspects of sustainability, but the human side needs greater focus. Moreover, it's clear that there are real challenges to address. Reports such as those conducted by Oxfam into the wine industry in Italy and of Finwatch looking at the industry in South Africa have made it clear that there are real industries for the sector. And there's also been increasing press coverage in recent weeks. In September, it was reported that the French public prosecutor in Champagne is investigating two human trafficking cases, as well as the death of five workers. And only on Monday, it was reported that seven people have been arrested for allegedly exploiting migrant harvest workers, one of whom was a child. And this public scrutiny will only increase, as will regulatory pressure. For example, the EU's supply chain due diligence legislation. It will mean that addressing these issues will become increasingly a matter of market access for all wine producers. So today and the other two workshops over the coming month, we'll begin to unpack this topic. And today we'll start by exploring what exactly do we mean by the concept of human rights. So looking at issues like forced migrant labour, living wage, and so on. To that end, I'm delighted to welcome our august panel. We've got Phil Bloomer, the Executive Director of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, Jantine Verdmuller van Elg, who's the CEO of Stronger Together, and Neil Wilkins, Head of the Migrant Workers Programme at the Institute of Human Rights and Business. I've asked the panel to make some opening remarks for half an hour, 40 minutes or so, and then we'll open the floor to questions and discussions. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Neil.
Thank you very much, Peter, and I'm really pleased to be here. I'm the head of the Migrant Workers Programme at the Institute for Human Rights and Business. Anyone who's not familiar with us, we're a civil society organisation that in many ways does exactly what it says on the tin. We try to encourage business to use the jargon, to use a human rights lens to view their activities. And we work across a range of different sectors, a range of different human rights concerns, and a range of different locations. I'm head of our Migrant Workers Programme, which is a very significant part of our work. And of course, I'd imagine for many of you in the wine industry, many of your workforces are migrant workers. So I hope particularly relevant. I haven't actually ever done any work with the wine industry previously and made the mistake of writing a wine event in my calendar for this event, which caused raised eyebrows from my boss when we had our catch up earlier this week. But I'm very pleased to be here, and we're really pleased to see that the industry is starting to take these things seriously. I know that Jantine and Phil are going to go into a lot more detail on some of the things that I'm going to begin discussing, but what I've been asked to do is to give an overview of the world of business and human rights, provide a framework for the rest of the discussion. As I said, I'm focused very much on migrant workers, and this is one of the key things that IHRB produced, and this is a framework for my own work. This is the framework for understanding all of the things that impact on migrant workers. This is the DACA principles for migration with dignity, over 10 years old now, and are used by many businesses and civil society organizations and governments around the world to allow them to better understand the issues and challenges faced by migrant workers at all stages of the migration cycle. I'm going to explain a little bit about how the business of human rights is organized and what the UN, the United Nations, does and says. And this is the framework that many of those of us who are working in the area of business and human rights would use. So it's the guiding principles on business and human rights. And they are very famous. They grew out of the work of the UN Special Representative, Professor John Ruggie, Ruggie and his team spent some years working out what needs to happen around business and human rights, and they were endorsed and finally approved by the UN Human Rights Council back in 2011. Since then, they've been picked up and used, and again, they're like this overarching framework for understanding many of the challenges that business faces across all sectors and all locations. And they're this sort of foundational framework on much of the work on business and human rights is undertaken. The UN Guiding Principles split into three very easy to understand parts. When John Ruggie was starting to develop the framework, there was an intense debate about what would be the responsibility of governments and what would be the responsibility of businesses in this space. Is it a government's responsibility to make sure that labour rights are being respected, or is it the responsibility of business? And of course, the correct conclusion really is it's the responsibility of both. And setting that out in the two first pillars of the UN Guiding Principles was one of the key things that the framework allowed. It comes down to this thing where the state has a duty to protect human rights. So that's not just for workers, it's for rights generally. It's to protect anyone who might be impacted by a business. For instance, you might live next to a factory that's polluting. So that ultimately would become a human right. It might be that you're employed by that factory. It might be that the goods produced by that factory impact on you in some way. All of these things are human rights, and these are what a state duty to protect is all about. So there is an expectation on governments to undertake effective due diligence on what's going on in their jurisdiction, and to make sure that appropriate legislation is in place. And of course, it doesn't just stop with legislation. For many of these things, there's absolutely no absence of law. It's lack of effective enforcement and enforcement mechanisms that we often see. So firstly, there's a responsibility on all states to protect human rights from the influence of business. And then there's also a responsibility on businesses. So companies have to have a corporate responsibility to respect human rights. So companies are charged with making sure that workplaces, for instance, are healthy and safe places to work, that health and safety legislation is being adhered to. But they also have to make sure that the impacts of their business operations aren't perhaps impacting on local communities, for instance, indigenous people who might live near a site of operations might be impacted. Or again, it might be that the company is polluting in a certain area in a certain way, polluting watercourses, things like that. And so there's a very strong responsibility on business to a corporate responsibility to respect human rights as well. Most of the concerns generally tend to look at what businesses need to do with their workforces, but it is far wider than that. And of course, you can, I'm sure, already see that as the state pushes back on business and puts expectations onto business, business in turn will push back onto the state. And so whose responsibility are these things? And the third pillar, and perhaps one of the most important, is that, you know, how do we solve issues when things go wrong? And this is about access to remedy, because bad things happen to good companies. Even a company that's trying their hardest to ensure that rights are being respected, things do happen. And so we need to make sure that when things go wrong, there are ways that people can access effective and swift remedy for those problems. So that might be an internal process within a company, or it might be a judicial process within a country. But we need to make sure that both of those things are in place so that anyone can access remedy. What does business and human rights really look like in practice? We think that we all know. We use this word modern slavery, and we think that we all know what modern slavery like. We all know that's chains and it's whips and it's incarceration and all those worst manifestations of what slavery is in the popular imagination. But the reality is that modern slavery and many human rights don't look out of the ordinary at all. They look like work. They look like the work that everyone else does. It's people in agriculture, it's people on fishing boats, it's people in factories, it's cleaners, it's security guards, it's van drivers. The chains that bind people nearly always these days are financial. The exploitations that people suffer these days are nearly always financial, and they're rooted very much in business operational procedures. And then finally, I just wanted to think about the reasons that the wine industry might need to better engage with business and human rights. The wine industry very often employs a temporary workforce where there's a lot of informal working. These things leave the wine industry at risk. It employs a lot of migrant workers. Very often these workers are hidden away. They're out on plantations, in vineyards, miles away from anywhere. There's not regular inspections of those plantations, all of these things, hidden workforces. Very often they're facing poor working and living conditions. Women workers will be facing gender-based harassment and violence. We know that very often these workforces aren't paid well. Very often they're on piecework, and sometimes the piecework rates mean that you have to work even harder to secure enough wages to make a living wage. Very often, they're not represented by effective trade unions. We also know that often the wine industry is abuts or is on Indigenous people's lands, or Indigenous people might be making up its workforce, which comes with additional risk. Often there's lack of government legislation, and as I mentioned earlier, lack of effective implementation. Sometimes there's no absence of law. It is implementation. How is the law implemented? The trouble is that if you've got a law but it's not implemented, it kind of gives a halo effect. Everyone assumes that because something is against the law, then it's stopped. But the reality is that very often it's not. Lack of remedy, as we've discussed previously. We're starting to see the impacts of climate crisis as well. And of course, from my perspective, this will lead to increased numbers of people on the move, both from the environmental shocks of climate change, desertification, salinification, things like that, but also economic, as old carbon-heavy industries close down. We're going to see lots more workers on the move. The other impacts of climate crisis, of course, are around heat and heat stress. And this would be a major factor for your industry as well, I'm quite sure. I was in Kuwait a couple of weeks ago looking at the effects of heat stress on construction workers on the building sites there, and the steps that the companies there are having to take to protect workers, and the impacts that that's having on their business. We're also seeing an increase in human rights due diligence legislation. We were just talking before everyone joined the call about today is anti-slavery day, actually, but we're seeing an increase in anti-slavery laws around the world, Australia, Germany. We're going to see new EU human rights due diligence legislation soon. Anyone who's supplying into America, the Americans are starting to use this with the whole release order system a lot, where goods are being seized at the US border if they're deemed to be the products of slavery. So we're seeing increased legislation, and companies are going to have to start paying much more attention to that. For prestige products like the wine industry, I think that there is enhanced reputational risk. It's the sort of product that journalists would like to get hold of. You know, there are certain products that don't attract attention. There are certain products that do. People employed in the wine industry, I think there's going to be that enhanced reputational risk there. And then finally, at the moment, there's a lack of collective industry voice and advocacy on business and human rights. And that perhaps is one of the purpose of these seminars that you're going to be having, to look at how the industry can work together. Because to be sure, these things are nearly always better managed when you work collectively. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for that intro. Your point about the collective approach is exactly right. As some of you will know, we launched a bottle weight accord last week, which I think demonstrates that a collective approach to these challenges works very well. And I think particularly with issues like human rights, where they are often systemic issues rather than company specific, whereas you've said there is a need to work with government. That's an area where something like an organization like SWR can really have a role to play. I also think you make an extremely good point about these things being hidden, that it's not that human rights abuses, labor abuses have a label attached to them. You know, people have a label on their back saying, I am being abused. I think that's something that really needs to be looked at in a lot more detail, that there really needs to be an examination in the industry of what goes on. And to give an example, I've just been doing some work in the Kenyan horticulture sector and was dealing with some pack houses there, where they pay piece rate. And it looks like a perfectly normal working environment, but we had some focus groups with some of the workers, obviously off-site. And you found that for them to make a decent living income, they were leaving there at midnight, having to get home, women mostly having to go home when public transport had stopped. So again, as you say, these things are often hidden. They're not as apparent as we might like. So thank you for that extremely interesting introduction. We're going to pass over now to Jantine, who can explain about her and her organisation, and is going to drill down into some of these issues in a bit more detail.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for inviting me, and great to be here on Anti-Slavery Day, as we said, and at a good moment where we just ended on the note of collective action and collaboration, which is very much what our organisation believes in as well. Says it in the name, we always say, stronger together, so a good moment to join in. Just to introduce Stronger Together, the vision of our organization is a world where all workers are recruited responsibly and have fair work free from exploitation. And how we do that since we started about 10 years ago is that we focus specifically on working with businesses, supporting businesses to put in place good practice both in their operations and their supply chains. But we always, as not-for-profit organization and impact-driven organization, keep the workers and work seekers that might be at risk of or in situations of exploitation at the heart of what we do. Peter started us off with a few examples that had recently been in the media when it came to the wine sector and human rights and business cases, and then even some horrible cases that were definitely on the worst end of the scale. It's a whole range of recent cases that we've seen all over the world and in a whole range of countries, because this matter of forced labor and labor exploitation happens in any country and happens in any sector, with some of those, of course, being at a higher risk for a range of reasons. But I wanted to make that clear that today we're talking with you as the wine sector, but this is something that is apparent everywhere. The thing is, with the media cases, it is something that is horrible to see, all those awful cases that we tend to read in the news. And at the same time, we always try to look at the little positive sides in terms of that cases are being identified and that we're able to see that this is a priority now and that we can take action to prevent other cases from happening. When we talk about the scale of the problem, I just want to touch on this briefly, because as we just said, this is a hidden matter, and therefore it's always hard to quantify. And when we talk about labor exploitation and about forced labor, we're not talking about numbers, we're talking about people. We're talking about men, women, and children. And therefore, I prefer to talk about people, and I prefer to talk about the situations rather than about the numbers. But it is important that we understand the scale to the extent that we can with the hidden nature of it. The ILO, together with the Global Slavery Index, Walk Free Foundation, have produced a report recently, an updated report to the one that they produced before. And the estimate that came out of that is that almost 50 million people globally were living in modern slavery on any given day in 2021. So that's a very large number, and that has increased a lot since the few years before the report before that came out. That is one of every 150 people in the world. If we break that down, it comes to approximately 28 million of those people that they are in forced labor. Another thing to make you aware of when we talk about statistics and the scale of this issue is that a large part of the forced labor is due to recruitment matters. 43% of workers are working involuntarily because they must perform different job tasks from those specified during recruitment. And that's not, you know, a small change, but here we're talking about where people end up in different situations with real deception and might end up in abusive situations. And around 1 in 5 of the workers, because of debt owed to their employer, recruiter, or related party. And this is where we start to talk about debt bondage. So a significant part of people in forced labor, those cases have to do with the recruitment aspect. It is good to see that in recent years, there is momentum on responsible recruitment across businesses, across government, and that we've seen some really good initiatives, both in terms of putting the spotlight on, benchmarking of what is going well and where businesses are making good progress, for example, through Know the Chain. which does certain industry reports, but equally also with businesses coming together in certain collaborative initiatives. And Neil is somebody that knows that very well through the Responsible Recruitment Leadership Group. Just to remind ourselves, when we think about recruitment, then we think about recruitment in the widest scope. That can be thinking about recruitment through in-house recruitment, HR. It can be through labor recruiters, those intermediaries that just recruit, and those labor providers where the whole process of employment is being run through them. And that applies when we talk about recruitment to seasonal workers and permanent workers. There is an increase of this risk all over the world and in any sector through a range of reasons: conflict, violence, persecution, the climate change still has had obviously a large implications which are relevant, cost of living crisis across the world, labor shortages that we see in many countries and in particular also in the agricultural sector, and immigration systems and situations like, for example, here in Europe where I'm based, Brexit, all resulting in a range of reasons and increased risks. We spoke about the risks. What are those risks and reasons? What's the business case for any business to take action? Some of those are to mitigate risks. But equally, the flip side of it is that businesses have an opportunity as well to demonstrate good practice. That's important to realize as well, that nowadays, when we think about consumers, when we think about buyers of any type of product, including wine, that having a good reputation and being able to demonstrate that you're putting the right practice in place really helps with market differentiation. Sometimes it will be a requirement, and with incoming legislation and legislation that has been put in place around the world, it is often a requirement or will become a requirement. But apart from that, buyers and consumers are always really happy to see good practice in place. When we think about labor exploitation, there is a whole spectrum that we can think about. Unethical recruitment and labor exploitation, legal recruitment and employment practices is sort of the bare minimum, you know, that that businesses would have to put in place. And at the very best end of the scale, we talk about responsible recruitment and fair work. If we think about then labor trafficking and forced labor, it is often closely connected with organized crime, targeting of vulnerable job seekers with the purpose of exploitation. And some of the examples are charging excessive recruitment and other fees to create that debt bondage. There are issues with accommodation, withholding pay, gross underpayment, and many more. If we look a bit then at what sort of models are there for forced labor, and I'll touch on them quickly, there's much more to say about them, but we have identified them as state-controlled or sanctioned, employer-controlled or complicit, so where the business itself, the employer itself, is aware of what's happening, might even be the perpetrator, or might know that somebody else within their organization or in their labor chain is part of it and they let it happen. And then the following three are more where the employer might not know what is happening. This can be through rogue managers and supervisors, so those within your organization that have practices that are resulting in labor exploitation. It can be through recruitment intermediaries and also through criminal exploiters and gangs. It is often not one or the other. There is often an overlap between those models. And all of those have different indicators and require different approaches to prevent and tackle. I just wanted to make you aware that the ILO has introduced a long time ago the forced labor indicators, 11 of them, which are very useful in terms of identifying what forced labor is and what the indicators are to look out for. When one of them is identified, that might be a case of forced labor. When it's more than one, then it is most likely a case of forced labor, and with the one, further investigation is needed. Now, some of them will be more familiar and will be more where people might know about this already, like a restriction of movement. But other things we just touched on, for example, like debt bondage through payment of recruitment fees and putting people in situations where they are made to pay this back with excessive repayments, excessive ways in which people are just forced to stay in the employment. Retention of identity documents is another one, and excessive working hours can definitely be an indicator as well. In line with the UN guiding principles that Neil spoke about, we very much believe in that as well. And a lot of the guidance that we provide is based on that framework, but then made into practical guidance for businesses to use on a day-to-day basis. But again, it is coming back to who have a role to play. And as a responsible business, how do I think about who is in my scope as a business to work with and to make an impact with? And that's the right holders, those individuals and communities, both within the workforce, but also as those that might be in the communities where businesses are based, for example. And equally, we think about other stakeholders. So who have a role to play, can play a role, who should come together on particular elements. And that includes the range that we see here on screen, certification and standards bodies. So it's great indeed to be here today with an SWR, government, law enforcement, NGOs, civil society, trade unions, everybody has a role to play, and it's very important to come together on such matters. Now, just wanted to make you aware that our organization likes to bring businesses together in collaborative programs where we can. We also work with businesses on a one-to-one basis, but we very much believe in making that impact at scale. And providing, as well as global solutions, very much looking at contextualized solutions for particular audiences in particular countries. And so here on screen, you see the countries that we currently run collaborative programs in, with some of those being particular of interest, I think, to the wine industry, which are Italy, Spain, USA, and South Africa. In South Africa and Italy, we do a lot of work in the wine industry already. And therefore, some of those common challenges that we've seen in the wine industry in those countries that we work in particular for importers and suppliers, is that currently it might not be top of the agenda of those businesses yet, because it's something that they might not know enough about, for example. They might not know enough about the work of vulnerability to exploitation or about asking the right questions. And if you don't know what to ask, then you might not see what's happening. Even though you want to do the right thing, then you might end up at that scale of labor exploitation, that spectrum, as I said, of not knowing what's happening. Limited management systems might be in place to help identify and manage the risks, and a lack of transparency of the supply chains, labor recruitment practices, and subcontracting. Again, by asking the right questions, we can really make a difference, and capability and capacity to identify and remedy the issues is another element. Well, those are the challenges, but luckily we have organizations like the ones in the panel today and SWR to bring us all together. And so therefore, in particular, in the next few workshops that are going to be held, there will be more detail and more talk about the good practice and the opportunities that there are. But for today, I just wanted to make you aware of some of the things that are available to you right now to use for free if you wanted to learn more beyond this initial workshop. A range of animations and videos, also some that are specific to raise awareness in the wine industry. A range of practical toolkits specific to the agricultural sector and also the wine industry that take businesses through good practice step by step, with checklists that identify, give businesses the opportunity to identify where they are at in their journey to tackle this matter as well. So that's all available on our website. Again, we can share this. Wanted to close then, before I hand over to Phil, on a quote from William Wilberforce. You may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. I think in particular on a day like Anti-Slavery Day, that is a good note to end on. Thank you.
Brilliant. Jantine, thank you very much indeed. It's very striking, that quote that you use. If you haven't identified slavery in your supply chain, it's likely you're not looking in the right places. And I think certainly that's something we see a role for SWR. You know, wine, I think, has come rather later to sustainability than other sectors, but I think it can leapfrog and actually could become a leader. And I think as we've done on Bottle Week, as we're doing on improving standards and so on, I think we can be behind the collective action. And as you say, there's already tools that we can build on. You know, we're probably going to set up a working group, develop tools and guidance, and maybe even do some geographically specific studies. So I think that collective approach is important. But also interesting, you mentioned the issue of labour recruiters and providers, because that's certainly been the Achilles heel that I think has caught the industry out in, certainly the French cases that I was mentioning earlier. And then we're going to pass over to Phil.
Thanks very much. I'm Phil Bloomer from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. And the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre basically seeks to be a hub for information about human rights in business. One of the aspects of that is we produce, as Gentine just said, the Know the Chain benchmark. And in August this year, we published the latest Know the Chain benchmark on food and beverage companies. It covers the 60 largest companies in the world, and it focuses on the prevention and remediation of forced labor and human trafficking in companies' operations and their supply chains. The bad news is that, unfortunately, the average score of those 60 largest companies is only about 16 out of 100 possible points. So the average of the industry is poor and is dragged down by a large number of companies that pay very little attention to these things. But the good news is that there is also an extraordinary range of scores. We've got five that score 0 out of 100, but we also have five companies that score around 60%. So that's an enormous range. And a number of these top scorers really have the effective policies and practices that are often in response to the major exposés of forced labour in their operations and supply chains. But they're also now best practice that everybody can learn from. I was going to start with an analysis of the problem, but I think we've heard a lot about that. The only thing I wanted to add, therefore, to what's already been said is to say, you know, that the key drivers of forced labour and human trafficking are always evolving. And criminal gangs are watching where the vulnerabilities are emerging in order to draw people into the human trafficking and therefore into the forced labour, where they can make a lot of money. We have to be just as good at understanding how those different migration corridors are evolving as well, and be alert to whether we're recruiting out of those corridors where the risks are the highest, where recruitment processes and policies and procedures are at their poorest. And of course, as everybody said, with climate change, that's evolving very fast around the world at different rates, and we have to be alert to those things. Equally, another one that I just highlight is the issue of conflicts and geopolitical tension, obviously at this appalling time that we're in at the moment with war. But the refugees, for instance, that have entered Europe from Ukraine, also those that have entered Europe from Syria, fleeing, often destitute and desperate, they get dragged into these migration corridors where there are people who are deliberately preying upon them. Now, I also wanted to just spend a moment emphasizing that, in contrast to all those new drivers and those changing drivers for forced labour and human trafficking, there is this counterwave of increasing due diligence legislation. And I'll go into that a little more in a minute. But just to say that, you know, the European Union is out ahead in terms of supply chain transparency and in terms of due diligence. By due diligence, what we mean is the obligation on companies to identify the human rights risks in their operations and supply chains, and then to have a remediation plan to deliver on that. Equally, to have a level of transparency about it. So we've got new legislation that's already in on the Company Sustainability Reporting Directive, and we've got now a final negotiations happening on the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. They're awful names for what are very important pieces of legislation that will affect market access for many companies in the future. And these regulatory approaches are growing. They're growing, as already been said, with new modern slavery acts, a second generation of modern slavery acts being brought in Australia, Canada, the UK, as well as import bans that are being really heavily used in the United States in an aggressive way to those that are importing from regions of high risk of forced labor. And the EU is already learning from that and already starting legislation on an EU import ban on these products from high-risk regions, unless the company can demonstrate that its own produce that it's importing is explicitly not produced with forced labor. So those are important areas. But let me move on to, you know, the key elements for action to eliminate forced labor and human trafficking in supply chains. I mean, the first thing I think to say is that we're identifying the best practice from companies. That's what Know the Chain seeks to do. It's what Neil does and John Thiem does. We look at the best practice and we draw out from there, as well as speak to workers' leaders and community leaders about what will work best for them. First of all, we have this issue of commitment and governance. The companies need to have a clear and effective policy to address address the supply chain labor rights risks, but they also need the leadership to implement it. There's no point in having it. We see lots of companies with beautiful policies and no leadership that insists on its implementation. So we need board members to oversee this particular risk as a fundamental one, particularly in this case, for instance, for the wine industry, as well as senior management responsibility to implement it. The second key aspect to it is that we need transparency and supply chain traceability. So the transparency of operations and supply chains is critical. It's the effective and essential first step to due diligence, to being able to identify where the risks are and to be able to therefore screen out those business risks through a real action plan on those things. And it's also, as I said earlier, going to mean, you know, whether people get access, it's going to be increasingly a market access requirement. The third major area is risk assessment, that third element of the due diligence process. At the core of the human rights due diligence is the process of understanding and identifying human rights risks that are present in a business operations. These are inherent to every business. We can't get away from it. If you're not finding modern slavery, you're not looking in the right places, as Jean Thiem's quote said. And especially, this is especially perhaps where brands and retailers adopt aggressive purchasing practices that drive down both the costs into in the supply chain, but also the risks in the supply chain. That's why the supply chain right through to the retailer is fundamentally important. And an unwillingness to disclose risks and instances of forced labor always signal a weak monitoring process and a profound misunderstanding often of the purpose of due diligence. The distinguishing feature of sustainability due diligence is that it depends on the effectiveness and credibility, for its effectiveness and credibility on the perspectives of affected stakeholders. That's why we've heard so much about workers' voice. Company engagement with unions, with collective bargaining, the effectiveness of grievance mechanisms, all these things are made so much more effective if we're actually speaking to workers. I've often felt speaking to many companies that they tell me lots of things that they're doing, but they never speak to the workers in their operations and supply chains in a organized and deliberate fashion to be able to find out where the bodies are buried. Because if you want to know where the bodies are buried and where those sources of forced labor or egregious exploitation are happening that have such a toxic effect on the rest of the workforce, you need to speak to the workers who see it, who may not be experiencing themselves every day, but experience it in terms of they know who else in the workforce is being hyper-exploited. So, and then finally, I just wanted to make a quick note on the access to remedy. As Neil and John Thiem have highlighted, you know, recruitment fees are the original sin. And right now, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, getting companies to repay recruitment fees, it was seen as ridiculous, couldn't possibly happen. Whereas now, because of the pressures that are in, you know, Tesco, Hershey, Wilmar, Woolworths, they've all been involved that's just in food and beverage. They've all been involved in repaying recruitment fees in order to release people from that debt bondage. just as forced labour and human rights risks are increasing, so companies' responsibility to enable remediation is increasing. Workers need access to trustable and effective grievance mechanisms in their operations and their supply chains. It needs to be clearly signposted, easily accessed. They need clear protection from retribution. And most effective for workers and employers is where the workers are involved in the design of that process. Unfortunately, most companies have a grievance mechanism that may look beautiful, but has no use. And if it's got no use, basically, you know it's not trusted. It lacks legitimacy with workers, or it's not promoted, or the workers don't feel protected enough to be able to use it. Because those caught in forced labour and human trafficking are inevitably highly vulnerable, and so they need special protocols. Vilmar, for instance, you'll know the oil palm company involved in a lot of, had a lot of exposés of allegations of systemic modern slavery in its supply chains and in its operations. They've got detailed procedures now with clear protocols. They disclose the remedial action that they've taken. They're in dialogue with workers' leaders because they know that's the only way that they can expunge this terrible curse from their own operations and supply chains. So we need to create that clear sense of companies' culture of zero tolerance. That's why leadership's so important. And where we need to investigate and learn from the allegations, which Tesco's been really demonstrating really best practice on. So to finish, you know, in summary, this isn't rocket science. It's just responsible companies. They've found effective solutions and we can all quickly learn from them. We need leadership. We need policy, transparency, the involvement of workers in the design and the risk assessment. And we need access to effective remedy that allows also companies to keep learning as the risks evolve. Thank you.
Phil, as ever, a wonderful tour de force, and thank you. And I think it's worth flagging up that the next of this workshop series is going to start to dig more into the detail of what companies and other sectors have done. As you say, that there's good experience and good practice on which the wine sector can build. And as Jantine said, the sector itself has done a lot of work in this space. I also think that point about the vulnerability of workers in this environment. When I was doing some work in China a few years ago, and the grievance mechanism was a box on the wall in the factory, and there was a security camera above it. So funnily enough, it wasn't very well trusted. Or another case was a mining firm in South Africa where all of the grievance mechanism stuff was written in Afrikaans or English, despite the fact that most of the workforce spoke Zulu or Xhosa. So I think those points are very well made. Although I do rather think your expression, where the bodies are buried, is rather too apposite an idiom for this afternoon's conversation. I'm going to open the floor to questions now.
And there's a question in the chat a comment in the chat about pricing and cost. And, you know, absolutely. What's been allowed to happen is that false price points have emerged for a variety of goods across all sectors. And, you know, and these price points are usually predicated on a degree of exploitation. And as Jantine said, you know, sometimes that's at the very extreme end of the spectrum. Sometimes it's, you know, to a lesser extent. But yes, a price does have to be factored in. Going back to the point that Phil made about the repayment of recruitment fees. Now, of course, recruitment is a business cost. Of course, it should be paid by business and it should be factored into the final price of the goods. And actually, from a payment point of view, if companies end up having to do repayment, very often recruitment fees bear absolutely no resemblance to the genuine cost of recruitment. They will be 3, 4, 5 times more than if the worker had been recruited effectively and efficiently through a fair process in the first instance. So if you end up having to make repayments, you will nearly always be paying more than you would if you'd recruited that worker fairly in the first place. So I think that's around price points and things like that, we need to have a very clear idea about what the genuine cost of producing any good is.
I think that's a point well made. I was talking to a wine grower in South Africa about a year ago, And they were sort of saying, well, don't ask me how much I pay my workers, because I won't then have to tell you how little I get paid by the trade. And I think this is a point, I mean, obviously it's a case in wine, but I've seen it in apparel and other sectors as well. The price point at the retail end often makes abuses much, much more likely. And I think, again, this is a role that SWR has to play, because it means that we can actually feed through to the trade and the retail end of the business that, look, if you want these issues properly to be addressed, there may well be a price implication. And I think that's an important one to say. Another question on the track. What would your advice be to big retailers who have the right policies in place of how to check third parties in their supply chain, that those third parties are compliant with those corporate policies? Who wants to come in on that one?
I'm happy to say a few. In terms of that, I think it's not a straightforward answer. I think the key step first is for a business, for this big retailer, to identify their priorities. And that can be based on risk. So again, that's coming back to that point that Phil made in terms of transparency and supply chain risk assessments. That's very important, because that will help identify where to start or where to place the priority. Then also it is setting out an action plan, a realistic action plan, because if we think about a big retailer, those supply chains are immense. So it will be easy for me to say, well, ideally, those checks are being done every half year. That would not be realistic if we look at the whole supply chain. So it's being doing your risk assessments and your prioritization to start with, make an impact effectively and efficiently. Because it is always preferred, if you are a retailer and you share a supply chain with a range of other retailers or other types of buyers, to look at how can we do this together. So we don't replicate efforts, but how do we come together, for example, in a collaborative program, to look at solutions and do checks, or at least get to a place where those responsibilities are shared, resources are shared. And then the third point maybe to make is, rather than just doing checks, how can you flip it? And how can you look at the preventative side? How can you provide those that you work with in your supply chain with the tools and the capacity building to help them to not get to a place of bad practice? And with that, it's not only building the capacity, it's also building the trust. And you mentioned the word trust earlier, Peter. I think that's very, very important when we think about supply chains and suppliers. How do we build trust? So when somebody identifies an issue, they feel like they don't have to hide it, but they can actually discuss it and say, okay, well, we've identified this issue. How can we come to a solution? Or that they can be honest about it and share about the solution. Because only when we do that, then we get to a place where we can really make a difference.
I think that's a point that's really well made. I mean, particularly with human rights, these are systemic. You know, it's not that you've got company A has got its greenhouse gas emissions are too high, in which case they can install technology to do something about it. Issues that you've been talking about today are systemic, and collaboration is essential. And that means being able to raise these issues. And I think one of the things we may find ourselves doing as SWR down the line is having slightly more in-camera conversations to actually try and allow people working in the same space to raise some of these issues. Phil, Neil, do you have any comments to add on that one?
Just briefly from me, I'd say, you know, a couple of things. The first is just highlighting what Jontine has said, you know, that issue of prevention. You know, one of the key things for retailers, if they want to prevent it, is to really look at their own purchasing practices and what they're expecting from their buyers. If you go to the buyers and say, get that price down another 5%, ask for another discount, they will go and they will demand that. And all that cost and all that risk will be passed down the supply chain, because the supplier will go, oh my God, right, hang on. Well, the manufacturer will say, well, hang on. Well, okay, workers, you've got to take the hit, because I'm not taking the hit. You know what I mean? So looking at that, aggressive purchasing practices are critical to this. And thinking about the long-term contracts, not short-term contracts, is also one of the factors that we see every day. If we want to eliminate this egregious abuse, those are the things that make an enormous difference, alongside freedom of association, training of managers in your supply chain. The training, you know, many managers have become highly aggressive, indulge in sexual harassment, in order to discipline the workforce, because they feel that everything that they're doing, that's demanded of them, demands that kind of abuse. So again, that training of managers to say that's not the way we want these factories to be run or these wine estates to be run. The second thing I'd just say is that do not rely on social audits. Use social audits, definitely, no problem. But do not rely on them as a source of the truth, because the social audit industry, as we know, is full of very substantial conflicts of interest. And therefore, we have to know and trust the kind of social audits that we have. We need to know that they've spoken, as Peter said earlier, spoken directly to workers outside of the estates where workers may be working. But even then, it's very important that companies, particularly where they see heavy risks, high risks, are doing their own deep dives collectively as an industry to try and find out what the truth is. So those deep dives are fundamentally important, speaking again to the key stakeholders, workers, communities, etc. That's the people who will tell you at least their truth, which may be substantially different from that which is revealed through a social audit.
I think, again, points very well made. And those procurement policies, I think, are vital. I mean, to come back to my Kenya beans example, I was in one talking to the manager director of one green bean exporter from Kenya, who was saying that they were selling into European and UK retailers. And when those retailers want to have a sort of price discount, you know, to try and shift more green beans, who ends up having to pay the cost? It's not the retailer, it's the factory. The factory therefore passes that on to the growers. I was doing some work recently in the apparel sector in India, same practice there. The costs are driven down to the factories who, at the same time, they're being expected to pay wages, have safe working environments. Those two things at a certain point need to square up. And I think that's an issue with SWR want to pick up.
I think just one other point around that is that the days of the bolt-on CSR department should be over. Now, this should be integral to the way that every function within the company operates. It's not this bolt-on sustainability team who come along after everything else has been done and then say, oh, yes, but we're worried about this, that and the other. This is the responsibility of buy-in teams. It's responsibility of human resources teams. It's responsibility at executive level as well. One of the key things in the original UK Modern Slavery Act was that things needed to be signed off at executive level. We talked earlier about withhold release orders, which is whereby the US Customs and Border Patrol prevents goods entering the US market. One big company, Top Glove, a Malaysian company that make rubber gloves, had a massive shipment prevented from entering the US. It cost them an absolute fortune. They were, to be honest, you know, they went through a process and now champions for best practice, we'd like to think. But we got them to talk on a panel that we organized. And interestingly, it wasn't somebody from their CSR team, their sustainability team. It was somebody from their finance department who came and talked. And that was the dramatic impact that situation had had on them, that they'd lost contracts, they'd lost business, they weren't allowed to list on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange for a while. There was a dramatic impact on that company through letting these things slide. And so these are whole company situations, not just the folks who deal with human rights.
No, again, a point well made. I remember one company I worked for referred to the do-good department on the fifth floor. Exactly. And I think those days...
The additional cost department was another common expression.
Precisely. Okay, well, at that point, do the panel have any last remarks to make?
Back to the point about if you're not looking, if you're not finding, you're not looking in the right place. And you should never judge a company by what they find. Because if a company finds something, at least they were looking. Yeah, as long as they then go on to address that, then there's no sort of shame in it. Ironically, those within a company who are charged with finding out details of modern slavery, their KPIs should be on the number of cases they find, and not the number of cases that they don't find, of course, because that is not an indication of anything. It's if you're finding it, then you're doing something right rather than wrong.
I think that's a very good place to end. And what we want to try and do with this workshop series is to encourage people to do precisely that, that trying to pretend there isn't a problem is not viable, but at least starting to go out and look. And then when those problems are brought to light, you know, making sure that there are that something can be done about it. And as I've said on a number of occasions during this call, I think that's where SWR can play a role. We can help surface these issues. We can help engage with governments, with retailers, with other parts of the sector to ensure that these issues can be properly discussed. You know, we can build on what's already there and develop some tools and guidance and lead collective approaches to addressing some of these things. Because it's clear that this is an agenda where there's reputation involved, there's regulatory requirements involved, even market access. We've already found with the work we've been doing with SWR that a collaborative approach works, and that's been very much borne out by everything that you guys have said today. So that's where we're going next. The next workshop will look in more detail at the experience of other sectors in this space. And we've got Nestle and Diageo speaking. And then the third workshop will start to dig down into how to actually make this work within the wine business. So actually a sort of a bit more of a to-do guide. Thank you, everyone, for coming. But most of all, thank you to Neil, Jantine and Phil for what I always knew were going to be excellent contribution. It's been really great to have you here. And let's keep the conversation going.